KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting Ben Folds' Paper Airplane Request Tour on September 19th at the UC San Diego's Epstein Family Amphitheater. For tickets and more information, visit artpower.ucsd.edu.
It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. For today's show, we're talking about the legal battle for Queen Bees, Phil Am CreatorCon, and Baby Bushka's last San Diego performance. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. We'll talk about what Queen Bees means to the arts community.
They're really, you know, mourning the loss of a place like that, if it indeed does go away.
Plus, an event celebrating Filipino-American creatives and how Baby Bushka is much more than a Kate Bush cover band. That's ahead on Midday Edition. A beloved community art space is at risk of closing. Located in the heart of North Park, Queen Bee's Arts and Cultural Center is considered a haven for many San Diego creatives. Poets, artists, dancers, comedians, and community members have gathered in the space since it first opened its doors more than 15 years ago. But a messy legal battle and massive property sale leaves the future of the cultural hub uncertain. Alma Rodriguez has been the creative force behind Queen Bees. Here's what she had to say back in December for the venue's 15th anniversary.
I think my vision for the location was basically be the hub of art and culture and provide people with a unique space to create new events and promote art and music and dance and everything that makes people happy.
Well, here to talk more about how this could all impact Queen Bees is Alex Riggins. He's a reporter with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Alex, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So break down what's happening for us. Where did this legal battle come from?
Sure. So the legal battle stems from the death of the building's owner. A gentleman by the name of Alan Hitch Jr. owned the building for many years, and his father, who was a San Diego City Councilman, owned it before that. He rented it out to several tenants, over the past couple of decades. But the last, since 2008, he was renting to Alma Rodriguez. And in Alma's telling of it, they became very close, almost like a father-daughter relationship. And, he helped her out several times, during the COVID-19 pandemic, he lowered her rent. They had a very close relationship. He was a mentor to her. And when he died last summer, his heirs, he didn't have any immediate family as far as wife or children. He never married. He never had children. So his heirs were cousins and some children of cousins that live across the country. And they believed that they had, the right to the property where Queen Bees is. And Alma believed that she had, certain claims to it. And so, a messy legal battle ensued, and that is true. It has been very messy with some very serious allegations flying back and forth.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into that more. I mean, what are both sides saying here?
Yeah. So, in Alma's telling, her and Alan Hitch Jr. were very close, and he left, several hundred thousand dollars to her. And he had also signed a lease agreement with her that she could buy the property for $500,000, which is just well below market, for that area of North Park and that building. So that was Alma's version of it. The family's version was that Alma had exerted undue influence on Alan Hitch later in his life, and that she had really taken advantage of someone who maybe wasn't the sharpest at the very end. Alma denies that. Obviously, she very vigorously denies that. She said that her and Alan Hitch Jr. had been friends for years and years, well before his health started to decline, and that there's no truth to the fact that the family is claiming that she had this manipulation at the end of his life The family even went as far as insinuating that Alma might have had, you know, a hand in his death or covering up what truly happened. Really just very, very serious allegations made, of course, in a civil lawsuit, right? Nothing criminal alleged, but in the civil lawsuit made some very serious accusations that Alma denies. You know, she acknowledges that she got about $400,000 from him and says that was money that he wanted her to have. But she denies, you know, all of the other allegations that she had any sort of undue influence on the decisions that he made to, you know, leave the building to her at a very low low price.
Well, I mean, in this big property sale, $2.3 million, who bought the building and what are the new owners planning to do with it?
Yeah, so Alma thought that she had a claim, right? She had signed this agreement with Alan Hitch Jr. that she'd be able to buy it for $500,000. It turned out that he had signed an agreement with another tenant. The property used to be like a 99-cent store or a dollar store, I think, before Alma brought Queen Bee's there. And so through a deal that the former tenant had with Mr. Hitch, and then through a legal settlement that they had together about a little over a decade ago, that former tenant actually had the first rights to it. And so it was actually an LLC that officially bought the building, but it's a former tenant, a man by the name of Ronald Shotland, who bought it and with, I think, some partners, and they plan to, you know, it's very valuable real estate right in the middle of, you know, the heart of North Park. And so they plan to tear down the building that currently houses Queen Bee's and turn it into retail space and 18 townhomes. It's going to take a few years for them to get all the licensing and permitting to do that, but that is the plan. I spoke to Mr. Shotland on the phone while reporting the story. The sale went through with the heirs of Mr. Hitch on August 21st. And so, you know, the property is officially with Shotland and his group, and they plan to go forward and, you know, fight any efforts by Alma and her supporters to you know, keep Queen Bee's where it is and the way it is.
Well, you spoke to various people about the cultural significance of Queen Bee's and its place in the community. What did people say?
Yeah, I spoke to a lot of people who, you know, host events there, whether it be dance classes or poetry slams, and they all just really talked about how meaningful that space is to them. You know, how it's a place where they feel comfortable, where they can be themselves, where they can host whatever it is, you know, whether it's salsa dancing, whether it's, you know, a goth night. It's really just a place where they can go and be part of a community. You know, so many different types of communities gather there, you know, for different events, and the people who, you know, are in charge of those events, who help run them, or who have attended, just really speak so highly of having a place where they can have these gatherings, and you know, whatever little corner of the culture it is, you know, they can have a comfortable and welcome and opening space there at Queen Bee's, and they're really mourning the loss of a place like that if it indeed does go away, and hoping that, you know, maybe Alma can open another location somewhere else where they can kind of recreate what they have at the current location.
Well, in your article, you write that Alma views the dispute as a classic David versus Goliath battle between a community space and developers, between neighborhood character and gentrification. I mean, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, her and her supporters, you know, obviously see this, you know, this very old building that houses this newer business, but really, you know, there's a lot of character to the building, and it's the old Dixie Line Lumber building that's been there for, you know, 90 plus years. And then they've turned it into kind of this piece of art, you know, and just the way that it looks on the outside, on the inside. There's a big mural on one of the walls outside. You know, it's this just this really special place to them. And they see it being, you know, torn down and just replaced by, you know, just kind of run-of-the-mill retail space, townhomes. You know, they're all sure to say, like, yes, we need housing. Like, none of them, you know, deny the fact that San Diego needs more housing. But they say, you know, why can't it be built somewhere else? Why does housing have to replace, you know, this hub of artists and this hub of culture? And especially, you know, it's not going to be affordable housing or anything like that. It's going to be townhomes, that, you know, 18 of them that are probably going to be pretty pricey. And so they just wish that that kind of housing could be built somewhere else, and their kind of cultural space could remain where it is, serving the community.
Well, there is this push from the community to get a historic designation for the building. I mean, what does that mean? Could that happen? And what will it take to be successful?
Yeah, so I think that push was kind of more, they were hoping to get that done before the sale went through. And so by getting a historic designation, you know, which would preclude the new owners from, you know, changing the outside of the building very much, or tearing it down, they were hoping that it would kind of dissuade the people with first right to buy the building. They were hoping it would dissuade them from purchasing it. And you know, they thought maybe they would be able to purchase it, or, you know, someone else who would want to keep Queen Bee's there. Now that the sale has actually gone through and this new LLC owns it, you know, it seems like quite a long shot, but they're still pushing forward. You know, they say that even if Queen Bee's has to move, you know, that building meant a lot to Alan Hitch Jr., meant a lot to his father, meant a lot to the community, because it was, you know, this lumber store that provided a lot of the materials that helped build up North Park. And so, you know, they want to protect the building even if Queen Bee's isn't there, because mm-hmm. they believe that it is a historic landmark. And so it seems like quite a long shot effort, but they're going to push forward with it anyway, even though the sale of the building has gone through.
Well, I've been speaking with Alex Riggins, reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Alex, thank you very much for breaking that down for us.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Coming up, how the PhilAm CreatorCon empowers and celebrates Filipino-American creatives.
The convention is all about bridging the gap between generations and putting together a dialogue so that people can get empowered and find support and thrive.
Hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. This Saturday, PhilAm CreatorCon will launch its inaugural event to celebrate, support, and empower San Diego's Filipino-American creative community. The convention has actually been a dream project for graphic designer Aaron Nabuse. KPBS Arts reporter Beth Accomando spoke with Nabuse about what to expect from the event, along with artists Mary June and Patrick Ballesteros, about Filipino representation in the arts.
Aaron, we're looking at the first ever PhilAm CreatorCon here in San Diego. So tell us a little bit about this journey to get here.
Yes, it started when I first found out the actual main character of Starship Troopers was Filipino in the book. So when I found that out, my mind was blown. And it put me on a journey of trying to promote Filipino-American creativity whenever I could. I first wanted to, you know, meet all these Filipino creators, and then it wasn't until I saw my friend Keaton Jones put together his event, Black Comics Day, that I thought, maybe we can have a convention for Filipino-American creators. And you know, I could have called it a Comic-Con, but, you know, looking at how Filipinos are active in a lot of different, you know, media, you know, we have comic book creators, you know, actors. I mean, even more recently, chefs are starting to take the spotlight, writers, tattoo artists. It was at that point where I said, I want to make this about bridging the gap between, people like Wells Portacio and up-and-coming creators who may have, need support and empowerment, and give them a space where they can get to know people who are in history. Like, we have Patrick Ballesteros here and Mary June. She's an awesome surrealist painter. So basically, the convention is all about bridging the gap between generations and putting together a dialogue so that people can get empowered and find support and thrive.
And what can people expect when they go there?
Well, I wanted the show to be small and intimate for the first one because, like I said, I wanted the exhibitors, who are all, pretty much industry professionals, to be able to have a conversation with anybody that comes to their table. San Diego Comic-Con is such a huge event. And, while I love it, it's really loud. And it's really not conducive to having a conversation. And I think that conversation is important. So I wanted my first convention to be an atmosphere where people can have conversations throughout the day to get to know the creators and for the creators to get to know any upcoming creators so they can give advice or, at least share some stories. So we'll have about 18 exhibitors in the National City large conference room, and you can expect panels throughout the day because when I'm at, say, events like San Diego Comic-Con, I love going to Artist Alley. So I want it to be sort of like an Artist Alley full of Filipino-American creators. And I love going to panels. So we made an effort to create a sort of diverse mix of panels. We'll have a panel about Filipino-American women creators. We'll have one about music, one about starting a podcast, one about content creation, and also the future spotlight panel will be about the Legend Spotlight panel featuring Wills Portacio and Bobby Rubio, which I'll be moderating. They're our first two guests of honor. So it is an honor having them there. I know that they could have been doing something else, but they said, cool, well, we'll be there to help support the show. So I want to make sure that our show gives them attention so that people can get to know them. And yeah, like I said, it's all about bridging the gap.
And you mentioned we have two artists here with us. And Mary, Aaron mentioned that your art has a surrealistic quality. So tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah. So I'm a surrealist painter. I sort of, just to kind of give a little history, moving here from the Philippines when I was young sort of pushed me in the direction of speaking through a different type of language, which is art and painting. And through that and through the experiences of different stages of my life, I sort of realized that the clearest way, kind of like what Aaron was saying, of bridging the gap between me and everyone else, no matter where they came from, was kind of showing my experience through a surrealist lens, having it be more about trying to convey a feeling with different images and different symbols, where when you look at my work, you might not know exactly what you're looking at, but the feeling between you and the person next to you is very similar. And that's something I wanted to convey with becoming more of a solidified artist that had a certain style. And my work actually centers around the subject of a girl, but often she takes shape in different forms. So the most important part about my paintings is that there is a human figure that carries the rest of the story, whether the story is uplifting or a little bit difficult to understand. I wanted to sort of create the ability that people can feel the exact same way as other people and feel understood. So that kind of fully encapsulates the idea of, like, the reason why I made art was just to communicate without words.
And Patrick, your art has a very different style, but it communicates very readily with people who are into pop culture. So tell us a little bit about your work.
So I describe my art as bringing a lot of that childhood whimsy into everyday things. Pop culture especially is something that I love, whether it be animation, games, TV, some books. I'm not going to say that I'm an avid reader, but some books, thanks to my wife. And that's my main priority. Everything that I do, I'm trying to do to bring a smile to your face. Lately, I mean probably the past few years before the world shut down and stuff, I've been incorporating more and more of Filipino culture, not just food and things like that, but stuff that I remember. I remember sporadic things here and there from going back to the Philippines, visiting relatives, but also being a Filipino here in the States and growing up here. Two very different lifestyles, but I never saw why I couldn't bring those two together. So through the vehicle of my illustrations and my point of view and take, I try to combine those things and make it just fun. Like, I'll put characters and a jeepney, something that I'm unveiling at CreatorCon, PhilAm CreatorCon, is going to be a new tricycle series, Chicicleta series. So that stuff gets me excited because it's a little bit of that Filipino cultural flavor with something familiar for people that don't know a lot about Filipino culture and things like that. And I found that a lot of people, oh, that's a cool bus. And that's my chance to go, oh, that's not a bus. It's actually a jeepney. And it's not like I'm trying to culture splay. I don't even know if that's a terminology. I'm not trying to do that. But it allows me a chance to talk about it in a more organic way, right? Not saying, well, did you know that? No, I don't have to do that. They're just genuinely interested. And then they go, oh, cool. I never knew that. So that's what I like about the things that I create and the different takes that I do is trying to combine what you see with things that you haven't seen before. And as Aaron said, bridging that gap, not just between generations, but between different cultures. And that's the fun part, is kind of putting that puzzle together.
Now, I just interviewed Chef Phil over at White Rice Bodega, and he brought up the idea that when people eat his food, they sometimes ask, are you Filipino enough? And you are actually wearing a shirt that says, I am Filipino enough. So does that question come up for you?
It doesn't come up. Well, I get some trolls on Instagram, of course. They're, hey, bro, have you been to the Philippines? I'm like, well, first, it's pare, not bros. But yes, I have been. I actually made this shirt because I saw a lot of videos floating around. Maybe this was about a year ago on TikTok and Instagram and all those other things where people from the Philippines and people from here, they're battling each other on like, oh, no, you're not Filipino if you don't do this. Oh, you're not Filipino. You're from the States if you do that. Oh, you're too Filipino. You're from the Philippines. And I was like, why does it have to be that way? So I made a sticker, and I told the story about it. And I had it at Comic-Con last year. And so many people commenting like, oh, my God, that happens when I visit this person, or that happens when I do that. And it is something that I don't think it's just with Filipinos. I think it's with a lot of different cultures where mm-hmm. people feel like, are you enough this? So I made that shirt as a take that. Yes, we are. I don't think so. And that's my whole reason behind it. Like, for me to wear this shirt, you know, or for anyone to see this, it's like, I'm not going to question you. Don't question me. I don't question you. If you love being Filipino, you know, rock it. Own it. That's totally fine. Everyone has a different way of expressing themselves. And that's what I think Aaron is doing with PhilAm CreatorCon, is bringing us all together because we're expressing our Filipino-ness. Again, I don't know if that's a word. with the people that, you know, you don't have to be Filipino to come to this. Actually, we'd love everyone to come to this. That's what it's made for.
And Mary, does that issue ever come up for you?
Yes, it does. I wouldn't necessarily, it's not too much of a big deal, except for the fact that, you know, when people come to me, and it's different ages too that ask me, like, why don't you paint for your people? That's even harder.
Wow.
And I've had that asked to me, because when they look at my work, it is very surreal. There isn't this like guiding light of what something means exactly. And for me, my answer back to them is, one, born and partially raised in the Philippines, so that's not even a thing. And two, it's like, my art is to comment on the human experience. It doesn't matter what country you're from. And building that relationship, then yes, we can talk about our different experiences in our different ethnic backgrounds. But
how did we even get to talking in the first place? It was because of surrealist art. And so I, when I tell them like, oh no, I paint for my people because I'm Filipino and I'm painting. And for me, I've always just had to accept that since there aren't specific symbols or certain colors that I'm pushing, I could still talk about my experience moving here and also and like moving here and adjusting to an American lifestyle. And what I tell everyone, which is funny, is that the root of me doing art was because I came from the Philippines. It was because I had to understand two languages and I didn't know how to express myself in one or the other because none of those were strong enough. And so I had to create a different language because I moved here. So the reason me being Filipino enough is just me painting. It's like, therefore, here I am, you know? So yeah, that's been my experience.
You should call it Junalog.
That's true.
Just saying.
Yeah. For real.
And Erin, you mentioned that it was discovering this Filipino character in the Starship Trooper book that kind of motivated you. What kind of Filipino representation did you grow up with? Like, did you see stuff in pop culture that you connected with, or were you seeing kind of an empty space where you wanted to see that filled?
Oh, yes. You know, for me, growing up, I mean, Ernie Reyes Jr. was there. I mean, Sidekicks. I watched that growing up. But I don't think, was he outwardly Filipino in that show? I don't remember, Patrick.
No, I don't think they really rocked that.
So
there was this, like, Asian kid.
Right, right, yeah. So
throw some hands.
Right, and then, you know, Rufio with Dante Bosco. But, you know, he's playing a fictional character, not necessarily Filipino. But and while it was good to see Filipinos in shows and movies, you didn't have actual representation of the culture on there. You know, fast forward now, you watch Cleaning Lady, and Filipino culture is really evident on that show. You watch the latest slew of Spider-Man movies, you know, Filipino culture is right there in your face. You know, it's trending that Filipino culture is getting more of a spotlight, but then again, you know, we mentioned food. Not a lot of people know about Filipino food, and which is surprising because when you take a look at Asian American population in the United States, proportion-wise, you know, we're the third biggest Asian American group, but that's not reflected in general culture or in the food. So, I mean, that's another reason why, you know, I wanted to put together the show, because I remember one time when I was doing my corporate gig up in Orange County for about, you know, I was up there for about 10 years. And for the first 6 months, you know, nobody knew that I was Filipino. They thought I was Mexican. So, you know, that when you take all those experiences into account, you know, it only makes sense for me to put together this convention, you know, based on, you know, my experience. And also, I mean, we're all fans of San Diego Comic-Con and conventions and pop culture. You know, it just felt right to try to put something together. And, yeah, I'm just so excited for this event and for this opportunity to once again, you know, celebrate and support, you know, the creators that we have in this room and the ones that we'll be having on the show, and also to empower the next generation.
That was Beth Accomando speaking with Erin Nabuse, founder of Phil Am CreatorCon, and artist Patrick Ballesteros and Mary June. Phil Am CreatorCon is this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the National City Library. Still ahead, Baby Bushka gets ready for their last San Diego performance and closes this chapter of their musical careers.
You know, it doesn't really matter that we're not playing original music, because it's interpreting music and experiencing that connection and as a tool for all that it can do for us is just so powerful.
KPBS Midday Edition returns after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Baby Bushka might be considered a cover band, but they're also so much more. Billed as the Kate Bush Experience of your dreams, the band defines themselves as a sisterhood centered around the music and storytelling of famed singer-songwriter Kate Bush. But it is time for the talented musicians to close this chapter of their musical careers. Baby Bushka will play their final San Diego show on September 15th. And we actually had the chance to peek behind the curtain and see how these local women musicians bring their performances to life.
Two, oh, okay. And then you would go run, 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 stop on honey, honey. And then I would.
You're hearing the Bushes rehearse in band leader Natasha Kozeli's apartment back in August. But even in this small, sweltering room in Golden Hill, the scene feels powerful to witness. KPBS arts producer Julia Dixon Evans was there. She later sat down with Kozeli in studio to talk about how this 7-year Kate Bush experiment came to be. Take a listen.
Take us back to the moment that you knew you wanted to form a Kate Bush project. Why Kate Bush?
I had been introduced to her music, and I just fell in love. It was like the summer of 2017, and I started listening to her and watching her music videos, actually, which were just wild and weird and went down this total wormhole. And I think what happened was I was at a house party, and I put on some... You know, there was a lull in the party. Everyone kind of went outside, and the iPod was just sitting there, and I put Wuthering Heights on by Kate Bush, and I didn't think anyone was going to recognize it. But all of a sudden, everyone came pouring back into the party and dancing, and I thought, wow, this is so fun. Kate Bush is so cool. And then sort of the idea just came, like, oh, it would be fun to do a dance party at the Casbah and play the music live. And so then it all just sort of happened one day, just sort of thinking about it, and I thought about the band, who would be in it. And there was a lot of amazing, you know, women that I knew that played music, that performed. And I thought it'd be cool if we all got together to do this in particular. So I emailed everyone and everyone said yes. And it just happened. And 6 weeks later or something like that, we performed at the Casbah.
What do you think it is about Kate Bush's music? I mean, it's incredibly beautiful. It's smart, mm-hmm. but it's also like extravagant and weird. You mentioned those music videos. What is it that finds purchase with people?
I think it's her authenticity. You know, she's just so genuine with her creativity. She's really not self-conscious about it. She's just sort of expressing what inspires her. She doesn't try to hide, you know, where her inspirations come from. And I think that's what's so wonderful about her work and weird and wacky, because it's so real.
So Baby Bushka is not a cover band or even a tribute band. It's something else. It's this theatrical experience in some ways where each of the songs has a narrative. It's choreographed and it's costumed. Can you talk about those decisions?
Yeah, I guess a lot of Kate's music are stories and narratives, especially her early work. And she sort of puts herself in the shoes of different human experiences. So you have songs coming from the perspective of a soldier or, you know, a ghost or a housewife or, you know, a father or mother. And so as we sort of started diving into the music, and because she's so theatrical and her music videos are like that and even her stage performances, it just made sense that you couldn't just go on stage and play the music. It had to be visual. It had to have that dance in it. She's so multimedia like that. And yeah, I guess sort of story arcs started to form with our show. And then as we started to get more into her music and into her later work, it became even more sort of mystical and spiritual and just deeper. It just kept deepening into her womanhood, into her experience of life, her maturing. And that has been how we've developed the show as well. So our act two right now is very much because of that. And you can see it in the show and feel it in the show. And then it's just amazing how that's grown with us as well as women and how we've grown too.
I think it's in the act two, the second half of your concerts, where I have seen over the years the most transformation. And I want to talk a little bit about resilience and the things that you as a group have had to transform around. You've been through a lot, whether it's a pandemic, a tragedy, particularly the tragic death of one of your members, Nina Leilani Deering. And before we talk about that, I wanted to ask you if there is a Kate Bush song that particularly speaks to you about getting through things.
I think getting through things, I would think about Jig of Life, because that song is about sort of the future self talking to the younger self saying, don't give up, you know, let me live, because in the future you have kids and you have this full life, and look, I'm here and I'm alive and I've survived. That's so powerful as a sort of like a totem, or, you know, sort of to hold on to that vision, that bigger picture, and that hope.
So in June of 2020, like we said, Baby Bushka member Nina Deering was killed in a car accident. What kind of impact did that have on the band?
It was a huge shock, and it was absolutely life-changing. I mean, she was a very big part of our lives and a big part of the band, and I mean a big part of the entire music community in San Diego. So it wasn't just us who felt the shockwaves of that. You know, it was when that happened, you're not really thinking about the band or whether you're going to continue. You're just sort of dealing with the death, the grief. And that, I mean, I think for all of us, and especially for me personally, it just changed everything about my life and what's important and, you know, how we deal with death and what does it mean? What did her life mean? What does her legacy mean? How do we remember her? How do we honor her? How do we talk about her? And that took up a big part of that sort of aftermath of that. And then eventually, there was a strong feeling that started to come that this can't be the end, and that one of the ways you remember her and you honor her is to continue. And so we sort of began the work of building that again, which was a lot of things. It meant finding somebody to take her place in the band and play piano, which was, you know, really foundational musical part of the band. It meant, you know, sort of building a show that honored her too. We built a whole memorial arc. And it was a 2-year process since her death till when we went on stage again.
There's something really special about the connection and the sisterhood on stage. And everybody in the group is and has been an extremely gifted musician in their own right. These members have PhDs, they teach music or in multiple other projects, and you run a music school, Calabash School of Music and Arts in Bird Rock. Mm-hmm. What has brought and kept everyone together?
When you go through these big experiences together and this history, you know, you're bonded. You really are. And not just the tragedies, but also the big highs, the tours that we've been on. I mean, it's been peak experiences, you know, it's a unique project, not just because of, you know, being 8 women and doing the music of Kate Bush, but because Kate Bush is so, you know, she's sort of this cult figure, and her fans are, the love that they have for her music is huge. And then the fact that she just doesn't really perform. So there's this sort of void of sort of experiencing her music live. And so we've been in a really privileged situation where we've gotten to meet a lot of people close to her and the fans in England, and, you know, sort of these huge highs and memories, and then sort of everything we've overcome. It's a lot, you know, it's bonded us, and we've all grown so much individually. Everyone's a totally different person than when we started 7 years ago. And it's such a wonderful thing to witness each other in that.
Over the last 7 years, Kate Bush's music is so enduring, but it's also found such newness as well. Like, there's a strange resonance on TikTok with the younger generations after it was in Stranger Things a couple of years ago. What was that like, you know, working with something that crossed multiple generations at the same time?
Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about Kate Bush. It's just, you have people in the audience of all different ages, all different life experiences. It's so beautiful. You know, when the Stranger Things phenomenon happened, we were on tour, on our second tour, and through the UK. And I remember we got back and everyone's like, you know, telling us that this is going to change our lives. You know, and I was like, I don't know. I don't know about that. But one of the things that I felt that did change was that the younger generation knew about her, you know, like kids in my school who wouldn't know who Kate Bush was all of a sudden knew. So I figured, well, we should do a children's choir then, because they're going to want to sing Kate Bush. And so that's really the big thing that sort of changed for us, is that we put on this children's choir at my school, and we had like 25 kids come, and they sang Kate Bush all year, and they learned about her, and they danced, and we had our first all-ages show at the Music Box, and it was absolutely wonderful to see them all on the balcony and singing along, and yeah, so it's been wonderful.
You've gone on several UK tours as a group. You play in pubs and small venues. Can you talk about taking this music back to its homeland?
Yeah, I remember, you know, when we had that first gig at the Casbah in 2017, we crowdfunded for 10 months because we were like, let's go to the UK next. It was just this big, ambitious goal. And when we were finally making our journey over there, I remember feeling so nervous, because I thought, well, it's one thing to play for American audiences where you have a mix of people who really love her, but also people who don't really know her music at all. But over there, I feel like it's going to be totally different. What if they hate us? What if they think we're frauds? You know, who are these American women going to sing Kate Bush? And I remember we got this email from Del Palmer before we had gone over there. He had discovered us somehow. And Del Palmer was not only Kate's partner, romantic partner, for a long time, but he played bass on a lot of records. He recorded and engineered a lot of records too, like Hounds of Love. So he was like her right-hand man, you know? So I remember when I saw his name pop up in my inbox, I was like, is this who I think it is? And he told us he was going to be at our first gig in London. Wow. We were just off the plane, jet lagged. The next day we're doing this gig, and I remember feeling so I can't tell you how nervous I felt. And I remember we're in the dressing room about to go on stage, and Nina comes into the dressing room and she says, he's here. And she said, I went in there and I saw him and I said, sir, are you who I think you are? And he's like, no. And his friend behind him was like, yes, yes, he is. And she's like, and she bowed. Of course, that's so Nina. And I remember she was telling us backstage, I was like, I don't want to know. And we went on stage and we did the show. And it was amazing because everyone sang along to every single lyric. I remember when Nancy did her solo, The Man with the Child in His Eyes. And that's one of the only songs in that first show, that first act, that's just piano and voice. So you can really hear the room. And it was incredible. Like, everyone sang along. There was no ability to just slow down or do rubato or interpret the song, really, because they were singing it like they've heard it all their lives. And I just cried on stage. It was so moving. And then after the show, you know, we're back in the dressing room and Shelby comes to the dressing room. She's like, Del Palmer wants to see all of us right now. I was like, oh, my God. And so I remember he was leaning against the back of the club. Everyone was kind of leaving the club. It was kind of empty. And he was like leaning against the wall and he looked so cool and calm. And we all just approached like these little puppies. And I was like, oh, God, what's he going to say? It was terrible. What are you guys doing? Go back home, you know. But he just looked at us and he said, that was brilliant, you know. And I was just, oh, it was amazing. And he was so generous, so kind. And we invited him to the dressing room and he just told us stories for like half an hour of Kate Bush. And And then he was like, yeah, I called her and I told her I was coming here. And she's like, oh, not another cover band. And he's like, no, but these are women from America. They're doing something really different. And so he was like, I'm going to call her tomorrow and tell her how brilliant you guys were. And I was just like, well, will you give her a letter to us from us as well? And he's like, yeah, but don't expect a reply. You know, she's kind of a hermit these days. And I was like, that's okay, just as long as she gets it. Mm-hmm. So that was that little story there is just what it's been like every time we've gone over there.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's amazing.
How will doing this project and this work shape you as a musician and an educator, as a person moving forward?
I think this project has shown me how important live music is and how cathartic it is, how vital it is for us as human beings to feel community, to, you know, sort of transcend and also share grief and the highs and lows of life. It's different, you know, like especially after the pandemic, it was just so powerful to come and play the music and feel the energy of the audience and also just how the music has walked all of us through our lives the last 7 years. And, you know, it doesn't really matter that we're not playing original music because it's interpreting music and experiencing that connection and as a tool for all that it can do for us is just so powerful. And that's what I see when we play, when we connect to the audiences, and you feel that healing that's happening in the room and on stage with us as well. So that's what it's really shown me. And I don't think any of us will ever be the same. I mean, I think this project has changed our lives for the better, and I'm just so grateful.
That was KPBS Arts producer Julia Dixon-Evans speaking with Baby Bushka Band leader Natasha Kozeli. You can catch the band's last San Diego performance on September 15th at the Music Box. You can read the full story on Baby Bushka and more on KPBS's Fall Arts Guide. That's at kpbs.org. That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.